because the Clintons considered the residence staff disloyal. The investigations were a punishment, and if we turned anything up, no matter how minor, long-serving staff would be history. Bill Kennedy didn't ask me to update Billy Dale's file because he knew the odds were high I wouldn't find anything. After all, I'd already investigated Billy Dale in 1991. Did the White House counsel's office make that investigation and other records related to Billy Dale available to his defense? The answer is no. Stephen Tabakman, Billy Dale's defense attorney, learned about the 1991 spin summary by accident just before the trial. That's why, in the fall of 1995, when two special Department of Justice prosecutors brought Billy Dale to trial after a 30-month investigation by numerous FBI agents, I, a now retired FBI agent, was subpoenaed to testify as a character witness. As it turned out, there were so many character witnesses, including my buddy Dennis, that I was never called to the stand. The single charge against Billy Dale was that he had mixed some press money with his own in a personal bank account. His explanation? It was easier to cash the checks that way. I was standing in the hallway of the federal court building in downtown Washington, D.C., while Billy Dale's trial dragged on. I was talking to Dale's brother-in-law. He told me why he couldn't believe the government's charge that Billy stole more than $50,000. "Mr. Aldrich, I remember one time that Billy brought his kids over to the house for a Friday night get-together. We were going to order some pizzas. I said, 'Billy, what kind of pizza do you want me to order for your kids?' Billy told me plain cheese, because he said his kids didn't like sausage or pepperoni. Well, when the pizzas arrived, some plain with just cheese and some with the sausage and pepperoni, Billy's kids tore into the pizzas with the meat and didn't even look at the plain ones. I said, 'Billy, I thought you said they didn't like anything but plain pizza.' Billy said, 'Well, the toppings cost $2 extra. We get plain pizza at my house.' Would a guy like Billy steal $50,000? The jury didn't think so either. They returned an innocent verdict in less than 2 hours. Sometime after the trial, I had a chance to get together with Dennis. Not only had Dennis testified against White House witnesses, he had testified against the evidence presented by his own agency, and he was now being subjected to minor harassment, such as anonymous letters sent to FBI headquarters lodging false accusations against him. I asked Dennis if he thought his testimony had been important to Dale's acquittal. He didn't know, but he was under oath and told the truth. He testified that he'd seen Clinton staffers, volunteers, and persons wearing visitors' passes going through desks and file cabinets in the travel office, tossing documents into the trash that was headed for the shredder. Dennis told me that late one night after the trial, he walked into the security office and found Craig Livingstone alone at his desk, staring out the window. "Oh, it's you. I'm surprised you'd show your face in here. I don't appreciate what you did for Billy Dale, Dennis. It wasn't helpful." "Craig, I just came down here to clear the air. I was subpoenaed. I was under oath. I had to tell. Hell, I wanted to tell the truth. What did you expect me to do?" "The truth, Dennis? Don't you know that truth is relative? Your testimony was your version of the truth. Truth is whatever you want it to be. And another thing, I don't ever want to discuss anything related to the FBI or background investigations with you ever again." Chapter 9. The President's Gone Missing. Rules for Radicals. All definitions of words, like everything else, are relative. Definition is to a major degree dependent upon your partisan position. Your leader is always flexible. He has pride in the dignity of his cause. He is unflinching, sincere, an ingenious tactician fighting the good fight. To the opposition, he is unprincipled and will go whichever way the wind blows. His arrogance is masked by a fake humility. He is dogmatically stubborn, a hypocrite, unscrupulous, and unethical, and he will do anything to win. He is leading the forces of evil. To one side, he is a demigod. to the other a demagogue. George Washington's rules of civility and decent behavior. Let thy ceremonies in courtesy be proper to the dignity of his place with who thou converses, for it is absurd to act the same with a clown and a prince. One day in the West Wing I met an interesting woman named Ruby Moy. Moy was working with Alexis Herman, the director of the Office of Public Liaison. I learned that Moy had worked at the White House before. She told me that she had worked in the Johnson administration for Johnson's chief of staff, Walter Jenkins. That really got my interest, because Jenkins was the father of the FBI spins. I was in my first year as an FBI employee when Walter Jenkins was arrested in the bathroom of the YMCA having sex with a man he'd just picked up. As it turned out, Jenkins had been caught at least one other time in the same circumstances, but President Johnson claimed he didn't know anything about it. President Johnson and his administration were already, in the summer of 1964, plagued by problems and scandals, not to mention the Vietnam War. He couldn't afford another scandal, especially one that involved a close personal friend, the man he'd selected to run the White House. President Johnson had a reputation for excess, especially on the personal side of his life. Many of his associates were not of the highest character, and President Johnson could not allow his loyalty to Jenkins, however strong, to do further damage to his administration. He also knew that public confidence in his administration was at an all-time low. President Johnson needed a way to restore confidence in his administration, and fast. To rid the White House and the executive branch of any other ticking personnel bombs before they exploded in the media, he called J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, and ordered him to create a system to investigate the backgrounds of all White House employees and all others who would serve in major posts, such as agency directors and cabinet secretaries. If the FBI investigated the White House staff in the same manner it cleared its own employees, who would think of arguing about the quality of the White House staff? But the image that the FBI passed or cleared anybody at the White House was an illusion, a neat trick created by President Johnson and his lawyers. While it was true that the FBI investigated White House staff members, the FBI was prohibited from coming to any final conclusions or recommendations about a candidate. Those conclusions and recommendations were to be made by the White House counsel's office to the president. The FBI just gathered the facts. It couldn't even underline or otherwise highlight the allegations. If the White House counsel's office wanted to ignore problems of character, they could, and the FBI couldn't do a thing about it. So really, one could argue that the weakness of the spin process was there from the beginning. It just took people like the Clintons to exploit it, and exploit it they did. Much of the information in this chapter comes from investigations I've conducted since retiring from the FBI. It is included in more detail in the epilogue, which is at the end of my background investigation into Bill and Hillary Clinton. It's the sort of information, based on sources who must remain anonymous, that would go into a raw FBI report, or that would help an FBI agent determine if a case is worth pursuing, or that would perhaps be used to obtain search warrants or subpoenas. It is by no means conclusive. But the information is deeply troubling in the issues it raises about the president's irresponsibility and callous disregard for national security. I have been informed by a well-placed White House source that there are times when the president, the leader of the free world, is missing, that is, cannot be located by staff, for hours at a time. Previous presidents have, of course, maintained an unbreakable link 24 hours a day between themselves and their key advisors, especially at the Defense Department. But today, late at night, when calls are placed to the president, he sometimes cannot be found. There is a message system, and messages are left. But in a crisis, messages won't be good enough. On several occasions, the president has called the phone switchboard and raised hell, claiming that he was in the residence, but that phone operators had not tried hard enough to reach him. The Secret Service should know where the president is at all times. But this is no longer the case, I have been informed, because the First Lady has booted them out of the residence. Moreover, she does not always know where the president is, because the Clintons sleep in separate bedrooms. All of this raises the question of, if the president cannot be found, where is he? One answer has been given me by another source, a highly educated, well-trained, experienced investigator who is conducting his own investigation into the Clintons. It appears that the president is a frequent late-night visitor to the Marriott Hotel in downtown Washington, which has an underground parking garage with an elevator that allows guests to go to their rooms without passing through the lobby. The president does not have a room in his name, and the guest who rents the room is known only to the management, though some information indicates this individual is female and may be a celebrity. The president's driver is believed to be Bruce Lindsay, a high-level White House staffer and longtime friend of the president. The car is parked near the elevator. The driver waits in the car until the president returns, often hours later. The car usually arrives after midnight and sometimes leaves early in the morning, sometimes as late as 4 a.m. I ask my informant about the president's Secret Service protection on these trips. And I should state here that if I had been informed that the president was protected, this testimony would take on lesser importance. But, to my dismay, I was informed that the president's midnight travels are unaccompanied by any security agents, even at a distance. How could this be? My informant himself investigated how Mr. Clinton may avoid Secret Service protection during these late-night liaisons. My source notes a guard shack is located at each White House car gate. The gates are large and electrically driven. The guard opens the gate from within the booth using an electronic switching device. The guards are usually facing out to see if somebody is trying to get into the White House. They are less concerned about cars leaving the White House. The guard observes exiting cars through a convex mirror that is about 18 inches in diameter. Seeing the car approach with the intention to exit, the guard opens the gate. When the car has gone by, the guard closes the gate. Rarely, if ever, does a guard attempt to identify who is leaving. Moreover, the tinted windows and curved roof lines of White House sedans make it nearly impossible to see into the back seats. A sensitive White House source told my informant that the president makes his exit from the White House in the following manner. The president usually leaves late at night, sometimes after midnight. The president leaves alone through the West Executive Lobby exit in such a manner that to the uniformed guard at the desk it would appear the president is walking to the OEOB, which is across the parking lot from the West Wing. In fact, once out of sight of the guard, the president immediately veers left and enters a waiting White House sedan, usually driven by Bruce Lindsay. The president lies down on the back seat, covering himself with a blanket kept there for that purpose. Lindsay then drives the sedan north through the electric car gate and exits, turning east on Pennsylvania en route to the Marriott. Not content with this information, I pursued it further with another source, a senior law enforcement officer with more than 20 years' service in a federal agency, who recently has been assigned to the White House. I questioned this source about the ramifications of the president's jaunts in the event something were to happen to him while he was unguarded. I was told that the Secret Service had a procedure to account for such events, and indeed to protect itself. Every time one of the members of the First Family countermands efforts to guard him or her, an agent prepares a memo noting the event. The memo goes into a Secret Service file, so that the agents and the agency are covered. It's called the CYA, or Cover Your Ass, file. My source used the term the First Family, rather than simply the President, because he says Hillary Clinton is as bad as the President. She has told her Secret Service protective detail agents in public to stay the F back. Stay the F back from me. Don't come within 10 yards of me or else. When the agents have tried to explain to the First Lady that they cannot effectively guard her if they must remain so far away, her reply is, "Just effing do as I say, okay?" The First Lady has even bragged publicly in her newspaper column about evading the Secret Service to go on a joyride. This behavior may help explain why the Clinton administration appears to regard the Secret Service as the enemy, in the same way that drug dealers are always on the lookout for narcs. I remember a conversation about the Secret Service I had with Craig Livingstone after Congress started sniffing around about the White House pass issue. Craig was clearly upset. "Who's leaking all this shit to Congress? Do you know?" "Leaking what, Craig?" "You know, this pass stuff and all that stuff." Livingstone and the Clinton crowd liked the word stuff. They used the word stuff a lot. "Well, Craig, it could be anyone. Have you considered it could be the media? After all, they see your people every day walking in and out, back and forth. They would see the passes, or the absence of a pass. Most of them worked here during the last administration, when things were done differently." "Nah, it's not the press. It's one of you guys, somebody in the Secret Service, probably." "I'm not sure about that," I responded. "There are hundreds of permanent employees, aside from the FBI and Secret Service. It could be anyone or a number of people. I would guess there is more than one leak, but who knows?" Craig said, "Well, I told your director this morning that I was sure it wasn't you or Dennis." "Look, Craig, Dennis and I have but one wish, and one wish only, and that is that our name never be used in any sentence with any higher-up at FBI headquarters, especially the director. Don't even praise us, because that will just bring us unwanted attention. Neither one of us wants to be promoted. We like the way our assignments are set up now, and attention or awards just cause the other agents to get jealous. Understand? Would you do me that favor and not use my name when you speak to Director Free?" "Hey, Gary, don't worry. I think it's that damn Secret Service again. They've had it in for me ever since I wrote that memo. They even refused to give me one of their pins to wear so that I could go with the president to events. I called Mac McLarty and told him about it, and he ordered the protective detail to issue me the pin, but they wouldn't do it. They defied McLarty." "What memo?" "Oh, you didn't hear about that? Your Secret Service buddies didn't tell you about that one? Right after the election, we had some problems with their agents down in Little Rock. They didn't have a good attitude. Bill and Hillary were complaining about them, and McGaw was not showing proper respect. He should have flown down right away after the election to introduce himself to the Clintons and congratulate Bill, but he didn't." Craig was speaking of John McGaw, former head of the Secret Service and now head of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF. When the ATF director was forced to retire because of the failed Waco raid, McGaw was moved over to take his place and clean things up at ATF. I knew McGaw. He was a good man, a very professional, disciplined, smart man. He and President Bush were always seen together. In fact, after the inauguration of Bill Clinton, McGaw went with President Bush to Kuwait on a victory visit of sorts. President Bush had made McGaw director of the Secret Service shortly before he was defeated. I had never seen McGaw fail to show proper respect to the president. Craig couldn't be talking about the same man. "Maybe he was waiting for an invitation," I said. "Nah, he was loyal to Bush," Craig retorted. "Anyway, I wrote this memo, this 4-page memo, and I recommended that the Secret Service be dumped in favor of the FBI. I thought the FBI could do a better job of guarding the president. Someone got hold of the memo, leaked it to the Secret Service, and they went ballistic. They have been on my ass ever since." He wanted to get rid of the Secret Service. Why not tear down the White House fences while they were at it? The Secret Service was devoted, and it was good. Secret Service agents were trained to throw themselves in front of the President and the First Lady, take a bullet, die for them, even if the first couple detested them. I wasn't sure I'd be up for that. It was true that the Secret Service agents I talked to had little respect for Craig. They called him the Sheriff of Nottingham or the Mayor of the White House behind his back. They felt he was into everything he wasn't supposed to be into and wasn't doing the job he was paid to do, which was process the spins to allow for the permanent passes. Instead, Craig was turning up at every function, directing them around and scolding them for doing their jobs. Craig was on a roll. You remember when John McGaw was sent over to ATF? I had a piece of that action. I was sitting here watching CNN, and there was Bush over in Kuwait, and right next to him was good old John McGaw, just like old times. That was crap. It was nothing more than pure disrespect for Bill Clinton. So, when we sat down to decide what to do about ATF, I suggested that McGaw be punished for his disloyalty and sent to ATF. Then, when we have ATF merged with the FBI, we'll have McGaw ride off into the sunset. First, he cleans up ATF's image, and then we dump him. We called him into the meeting and gave him his options. He had no choice. Take ATF or hit the road, Jack. No wonder Craig was having trouble with the Secret Service. The Clinton administration had been giving the Secret Service a hard time from day one. So it's no surprise that the Secret Service came up with its CYA file. That file is now a very important national security document, for it would allow Congress, using its oversight authority, to document one of the most serious and irresponsible breaches of security in U.S. history. Nor would an investigation have to rely on this file alone. I asked one of my sources what would happen if even some of the information on these matters was aired publicly. He told me that, of course, the first thing that would happen is that a very large number of people would be fired as suspected leakers, since the Clintons would move to punish the innocent and guilty alike. But he also told me the second thing to happen would be a wholesale stampede by the fired staff and their supporters up to Congress, with the rest of the story, since the permanent staff have about had it with the antics and poor manners of Bill and Hillary Clinton. When I was in the White House, I heard enough stories to confirm that assessment. One day, I got a call from a friend named Carol, who had worked in the speechwriter's research office for the Bush administration. Carol telephoned me about worrisome stories she was hearing from a friend inside the Clinton White House. "Gary, I can hardly believe how nasty Bill Clinton is toward his staff." "What do you mean?" "Well, the Filipino staff threatened to quit." "What? I'm serious." She mentioned the Filipino staffer who'd told her. That staffer was a good enough source for me. There are about a dozen men who are from the Philippines, or whose parents were, who served the president and vice president. As distinguished U.S. Navy personnel, they work in the OEOB and the West Wing, and they run the Navy mess. They are part of the permanent staff and are renowned for their dedicated, discreet, intelligent, and loyal service. They are, of course, investigated by the military or by the FBI through the spin process. And they're proud of their positions. The Filipino stewards are a White House tradition, marking the long-standing friendship between the Philippines, the United States in general, and the U.S. Navy in particular. The positions are a badge of honor, and these staffers had trained for and looked forward to holding these positions. For them to quit was unthinkable. I knew that the White House's prize French chef had walked. So had others in the kitchen staff, because of what they considered the outrageous demands and rude behavior of the Clintons, such as giving the staff an hour's notice for luncheons with numerous guests, and then throwing a fit if the food wasn't ready on time. In the chef's case, an additional factor was the president's preference for fried food over haute cuisine. But the Filipino stewards resigning en masse was a different thing entirely, more like the beef-eaters threatening to leave the Tower of London or the Swiss guards threatening to abandon the Vatican. "Carol, what happened?" "He's treated them like dirt, Gary, and they're not used to that. I heard that for the first few months he just ignored them." I would have thought this odd, because Bill Clinton had struck me as gregarious to the point of being unpresidential. I once passed him in a White House hallway, and he nodded to me and said, "Hello, sir," as though he were class president and I was the school principal. For him to ignore people would be like him passing a basket of French fries and not trying to bury his face in it, as documented by Hunter S. Thompson, almost unthinkable. But I had heard many similar stories about his coldness to permanent staff. "What do you mean he ignored them?" I asked. "Gary, he didn't even acknowledge they existed. It was as if they were just inanimate objects that took up space. So they did the only thing they could do under the circumstances. They glared at him. They pretended they didn't hear him when he called. They pretended they didn't understand him when he asked for things. You know, the usual drill, what anyone would do to punish a jerk. They played dumb. They brought him a Coke if he asked for a Pepsi, mustard instead of ketchup, chips instead of fries, that kind of thing. Can you picture that?" Yes, I certainly could, and I had to chuckle. I could just imagine the scene. "I asked for chicken salad, not tuna, damn it. This is tuna." "Yes, Mr. President, of course you did. Sorry, Mr. President, sir. I'll get the correct sandwich right away, Mr. President." And as the little man in the white jacket turns away, a barely perceptible grin momentarily creases his face. I could just see it. So what happened? Did they ask for a transfer? No. Somebody with a brain got wind of what was happening, maybe Mark Guerin, and finally told the president that he was royally tweaking off the stewards. So he apologized to them, but frankly, they didn't buy his apology. He said he was real sorry, but that he was really busy and had a lot on his mind, like George Bush didn't. The stewards have seen presidents come and go. They know better. They know when they're respected. What Carol told me about the man lined up with what I was hearing lately from Secret Service agents, resident staff, and other permanent staff. Usually, Bill Clinton was not overtly abusive like Hillary, but he could appear just as haughty and arrogant. The resident staff told me that Bill Clinton walked right by them every day and looked right through them as if they didn't exist. When he did speak to them, it was in tones they thought were insulting. They felt the Clintons and their staffs didn't appreciate the White House, and didn't appreciate them, the ones who kept the White House running. What gave their complaints added weight was that the staff rarely, if ever, complained in the Reagan-Bush days. The permanent staff was getting fed up with the president's behavior. So was I, even while I was still at the White House. I remember one incident in particular. On 19 April 1993, I was working at the White House on some investigative reports when my wife called and told me to turn on the television. I asked what channel. She said, "Any channel." I turned on the TV and watched as FBI agents in armored personnel carriers pushed in windows and walls and sprayed tear gas inside the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. Smoke and flames burst out of the building. I knew there were children inside. I waited impatiently to see FBI agents lead them to safety, but there was no safe place. More than 20 children died that day. As soon as the initial shock was over, I listened in disbelief as the White House and Janet Reno claimed we'd just witnessed a mass suicide. That's not what it looked like to me. On 23 April, 4 days after the burning of the Branch Davidian compound, I again listened to President Clinton try to explain to the nation why and how such a nightmare had occurred. He steered attention away from the White House, which had approved the plan of attack on cult leader David Koresh, and focused on the FBI for having developed the harebrained scheme in the first place. But knowing the FBI as I did, I was virtually certain that Janet Reno had been presented with a variety of options. I was sitting in Deborah Coyle's office when the president walked around the corner. "Well, Deborah, who's this? Hiya." President Clinton had a wide grin on his face, but I was still thinking about all those kids being burned to death. "Hello, Mr. President. I'm Gary Aldrich, one of the two FBI agents assigned here at the White House." "Well, FBI, huh? How'd you like the way I defended the FBI just now? Did you hear the press conference I just gave?" What was I supposed to say? That I had just about gagged when I heard him lay the entire mess at the FBI's door? "Mr. President, since you asked, I must say I'm just a little confused at the characterization of this as a mass suicide. I can't see how children can make a decision to commit suicide." "Well, Well, these kids were badly abused. Reminds me of a similar circumstance in Roman times, when the forces of... Obviously, his knowledge of Roman history exceeded mine, but whether it was relevant or merely a verbal smokescreen is a pertinent question. Well, Agent Aldrich, I'm sure glad to meet you. I've heard about you guys. You're doing a good job. Keep it up. Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. President. He walked on. Deborah was grinning. Deborah, does he do this often? You know, just walk around and talk to total strangers? How does he find the time? Yes, Gary, I've worked for him for years, and he'll never change. He's always on. Well, the President's act, if that's what it was starting to wear thin on me. Chapter 10 So What? Part 2 Rules for Radicals. Change means movement. Movement means friction. Only in the frictionless vacuum of a non-existent abstract world can movement or change occur without that abrasive friction of conflict. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Artificers and persons of low degree ought not to use many ceremonies to lords or others of high degree, but respect and highly honor them. And those of high degree ought to treat them with affability and courtesy, without arrogance. By the summer of 1993, almost 3 years to the day I first entered the White House, I went to my supervisor and threw my White House pass on his desk. I told him that I was disgusted and wanted out. I was the first FBI agent assigned to the White House who had ever asked to be transferred. It was time to go while I could still look at myself in the mirror. I didn't want to become just another victim of the Clintons, used to suit their political agenda, used to torment the innocent, used to provide cover to the guilty. But the FBI would not let me leave the White House. The caseload was too high. I was stuck, but I no longer had to investigate the Clinton political staff. I would be in charge of reinvestigating the permanent staff, and that job had always been a pleasure. Our periodic inspection was just around the corner. Dennis learned through his friends at headquarters that he and I were to be targeted by the inspectors, blamed for the late cases. We were being set up as scapegoats. I pulled out all my old case logs and began to prepare my defense. Dennis did the same. My accounting background came in handy whenever I needed to make charts, graphs, or schedules, and this time was no exception. I proved with my schedules that, from the very beginning of the Clinton administration, straight through to the fall of 1993, the FBI spin requests had come in fits and starts, with no apparent relationship to who was being investigated or how long the particular person had been inside the White House. Even after the violent death of Vince Foster, which should have been the White House counsel's wake-up call, nothing had changed. After the forms that enabled the FBI to conduct an investigation were filled out, dated, and signed, they were sent somewhere to gather dust. My study revealed that some forms that eventually ended up on my desk had been sitting somewhere for months for no apparent reason. Dennis and I were receiving many forms a full 7 months after they had been filled out and signed. We could easily determine the extent of the delay from the dated signatures on the form. In some cases, the date was scratched through with a pen, and a current date was penned in next to it, and I guess someone in the counsel's office thought that made it okay. The effect of these tardy submissions to the FBI was manifold. 6 months is a long time in the life of a new White House employee. That time might include a change of residence and a change of office or agency within the Clinton administration. That made the cases more difficult to close. Since initially no apparent thought was given by the Clintons to matching experience and education with particular job vacancies, there was a lot of reshuffling of White House jobs. In addition, more than a few people were already quitting. The FBI had agreed to finish the cases within a specified time frame, but of course that agreement was based on the assumption that the forms would be turned in on time, complete and current. A lot of them were late, and most were neither complete nor current. Because additional information was needed to conduct a full investigation, it was necessary for Dennis and me to find the staffer under investigation and help him update the forms. This was holding their hands, as far as I was concerned, and I resented having to do it. What I gathered as evidence to protect myself was absolute proof of what I had seen all along. Of 78 cases that I surveyed, 60 had been delayed by negligence on the part of the counsel's office. Of those 60, 42 of the staffers had in fact filled out their forms on or about 20 January 1993, the day of the inauguration. The counsel's office held on to the forms as long as 7 months, while these staffers, whose backgrounds were unknown to the Secret Service, wandered the hallways of the White House and the NSC, where piles of top-secret documents were the rule, not the exception. These mystery guests could and did wander out to the South Lawn and were within handshaking distance of the President, and no security officer or Secret Service agent knew who the hell they really were, beyond appearances, and that was a worrisome clue in itself. The day finally came for the FBI inspector to review my cases. I walked into my appointment with my charts, graphs, and other documents. When he saw I was no pushover, he quickly backed off. I began to tell him of the serious problems that Dennis and I had documented, and told him that the FBI was being used. I predicted that there would be more, not less, trouble ahead for the FBI. His response to my warning was, "I'm here to investigate your FBI field office and your work, not problems at the White House." One day I met an interesting fellow named Billy Burt Shaddox, a former Navy and White House photographer and a friend of George Saunders. He shared our dismay about the Clinton administration. "I came here after the inauguration to help the photo office get set up, but this administration is a mess. I've never seen one like it. They have no respect for the White House or for the presidency or even for the president. They call him Bill, for goodness sake. I call them kids in cutoffs. They're a bunch of middle-aged hippies." Shaddox explained that he had tried to take some of them aside and explain where they were and what it all meant, but they didn't get it. Shaddox indicated that the White House photographers were disgusted, too. "They're getting assignments to go over to the OEOB and take pictures of somebody's birthday party and nonsense like that, and they don't like it." "These people are paid government employees. They have regular assigned duties, and here they are walking around taking pictures of Susie's big day. Geez, don't they know that kind of thing is an abuse? Government employees, government time, government cameras, government film, processing. Don't they know that it's the same as stealing?" We talked about Shaddox's Navy detail days in the Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan White Houses as a photographer. Gary, each of the administrations was different, but all at least seemed to have respect for the White House and for the presidency. Carter was casual, but these people are off the scale. What about Clinton himself? He likes to compare himself to JFK. No way is this president like JFK. More like Johnson, if you ask me. President Johnson was the crudest president I've known, and he was a womanizer, too. Johnson used to go out to his friend's house to play poker, or at least that's what he said. His poker story was just cover for what he was really doing, which was meeting lady friends. He'd arrive, and the babes would be there waiting. Johnson was very crude. He had no restraint at all. He didn't care where he was or who saw him when he decided to relieve himself. He'd just whip her out and let her go. The Secret Service guys told me that if he got the urge outside the Oval Office, he wouldn't even bother to hold it until he got to the residence. If nature called, he would just stop at the Rose Garden, walk over to the bushes, and let her rip. One of the agents told me about when Johnson was waving goodbye to some guests. He could still see their car taillights when Johnson unzipped and whipped old Charlie out. There was a strong wind, and it blew his stream all over the leg of the Secret Service agent standing next to him. The agent jumped back, swearing. "Mr. President, you're peeing on my leg, sir." Johnson said, "Son, that's a president's prerogative." Shaddox swore he'd heard that story from the offended agent. According to Shaddox, Johnson also had a drinking problem. He had a Filipino steward who had the key to a locked liquor cabinet in the Oval Office. Johnson would go over and make two strong drinks. After the second, the steward would lock the cabinet and put the key on a chain he kept around his neck. He was instructed by Johnson to refuse to give up the key, no matter what. Shattucks would not go so far as to say that he thought Clinton had a drinking problem, but Clinton's constant rosy glow seemed to be caused by something more than just a simple allergy. We agreed that President Clinton had a classic drinking man's face. George Saunders, the man without a real job, invited me to the Navy mess in the West Wing to have lunch. It was Mexican Day, and he had nachos. Sitting across from us was Rahm Emanuel, who was notorious for his temper tantrums and garbage mouth. Trained as a ballet dancer, he spent a lot of time, according to Elizabeth Drew in her book On the Edge, gliding in and out of Stephanopoulos' office. He was also one of the president's senior advisors, but could never be accused of knocking himself out in the appearance department. Today, a normal work day in the White House, he was wearing casual slacks, a polo shirt, no jacket, no tie. President Clinton was in Denver meeting the Pope. "Gary," Saunders said, "I'm doing nothing at all. My contract runs out the end of this month, and I don't think it'll be renewed. I'm just window dressing around here, to make it look like they have a security program, that's all. There's really no one covering security at all. No one's allowed to. Craig Livingstone means well. I know he does. He tries to help, but he's up against it with this counsel's office." "Yeah, I know," I said, and I wondered whether Craig was counting the days like we were. But Congress was beginning to smell a rat in the White House. On 19 August 1993, in response to an inquiry from Congressman Frank Wolf of the House Appropriations Committee, which oversees the budget for the White House, Mac McLarty wrote, "To our knowledge, there have been no material changes in security procedures at the White House when compared to those of previous administrations." This was absolute nonsense, of course. There had been wholesale change, and McLarty knew it. Or Nussbaum, Foster, Kennedy, and others had lied to him. Congressman Wolf responded with a letter dated 22 September 1993 that said, in part, "I also understand that many of the staff and volunteers continue to hold temporary passes, with many clearances pending and being held in the White House counsel's office for further review. I am told that information on many individuals is of a nature that would, in previous administrations, make them ineligible for clearance. What is the status of these pending clearances?" But even with Congress's growing interest in the suspected breakdown of White House security, nothing happened. Nothing changed. Hundreds of staff roamed far and wide, their background investigations sitting in a pile in a corner of Bill Kennedy's office. Bill and Hillary Clinton, their daughter, national security, and the entire senior staff, for that matter, all the staff, were subjected to continuing and unreasonable risk as a result of the failed security program. Persons with the little T passes were still driving in, entering with boxes and briefcases, able to avoid the magnetometer, and able to avoid body and briefcase searches, even after Vince Foster's tragedy had shown how vulnerable we were. Of course, the Secret Service had insisted on tight security. They always did. They didn't want to allow persons without permanent passes to come and go without being searched, but the Clintons felt that the Secret Service's searches were a hassle and unnecessary, and just another way for the disloyal Secret Service agents to bug the Clintons and their friends. So they ordered the Secret Service to modify their security program to fit the petulant and immature demands of the Clinton staff, and there wasn't a damn thing that could be done about it. I was invited to lunch with Phil Larson. He had been gone from the White House for 9 months, and I heard through the grapevine that he was working for Congressman William Clinger on the Government Operations Subcommittee, minority staff. In essence, Larson was an investigator for the committee that had oversight responsibilities over the White House. "Gary, I'm receiving lots of calls from friends of mine down at the White House, and what I'm hearing disturbs me. I just want to make you aware that the Oversight Committee is probably going to look into the White House security problems and the White House pass situation. We may ask GAO to investigate, and that might involve the FBI. I'm telling you this as a friend. Can you confirm that all the Clinton people are walking around without a pass? No, I can't. I can't say that I've looked at every person's pass, those that bother to wear them, to see if they have the little T or have graduated to a permanent pass, but I can tell you it's a problem. According to what I've heard, the personnel office is another mess, with lots of people working for months without a presidential appointment or any other documentation that would justify paying them. I listened to Phil's other concerns. Obviously, he had many sources, but I told him I couldn't comment further. We parted company, with Phil warning me that Congress was probably going to look into the Clinton administration's handling of background investigations, passes, and other matters that might have an effect on me. I thanked him for the information and went to the House of Representatives, where I was spending much of each day. It was a relief to go to the House, which was much better organized than the dysfunctional Clinton White House. I still had to go to the White House every day for administrative reasons, and that was a real drag. In fact, I thought that would make a good bumper sticker. Working in the Clinton White House is a real drag. I ran into a Secret Service buddy who confirmed that Congress was asking questions about the conduct of the counsel's office with regard to White House passes and security clearances. A congressman had apparently sent a letter to Nussbaum asking him to respond to allegations that the White House security program and the quality of White House staff had taken a nosedive. The Secret Service, my friend told me, would argue, if challenged by Nussbaum, that suitability was the counsel's problem, while the Secret Service was focused on the physical protection of the president. But I wondered, who was supposed to grant security clearances and maintain national security? Was there no one at the gate? The next day, I ran into some more friends from the Secret Service. We talked for a few minutes. They were very concerned, as I was, about security lapses. I wonder if the Department of Justice or Congress knows that what this administration is doing is illegal, asked one. To me, it's a clear violation of national security, established standards of conduct, and executive orders of the president. I said, there are bigger issues here than just what the Department of Justice or Congress thinks about all of this. This conscious downplaying of standards sets legal precedents. Now that they've allowed just about anyone in the White House, they may have no legal means to get rid of real risks. After all, how can they fire someone for serious character problems when all anyone would have to do is trot out about 25 of the president's finest with problems just as bad? That would be about it. They think that standards are set up by straights like us, but they're for the protection of the presidency, and these Clintons are destroying that protection. They're destroying the office by bringing in people who scurry if you shine any light on them. I was obviously nearing the end of my tether. I wouldn't normally have spoken like this. Another agent struck a lighter tone. They sure like it loose over there. I wonder why. I didn't wonder anymore. I knew. On 9 September 1993, the Clinton administration's long-awaited and highly touted Reinventing Government report was released. The project was organized by Vice President Gore. A separate office had been established for it, and millions of dollars were spent to produce this 168-page booklet. The report interested me because it included a plan to merge the FBI, the ATF, and the DEA, something that had been considered and studied and rejected before. Now, here it was again. It took me a while to find the issues that interested me, because the booklet wasn't indexed and had no table of contents. My eyes glossed over some of the booklet's exciting advice. Hold all federal employees accountable for results. Eliminate what we don't need. And streamline background investigations for federal employees. This was interesting. I read on. The current method of completing background investigations is time-consuming and inefficient. Yeah, I thought. They sure are inefficient if nobody is reading them. Dennis and I met Anthony Marseca, a special agent from the Criminal Investigative Division of the U.S. Army, detailed to the Security Office to assist Craig Livingstone. He explained that his job was to improve the efficiency of the security office. But within a few minutes, I wondered if he didn't have another possible assignment. Marseca made openly disparaging remarks about Craig and his operation, which made me suspicious that he was trying to draw us out. Were we the ones blabbing about the council's office? The girls in the council's security office are sloppy in their work, he said, and they're way behind. There's no system. They're completely disorganized. That sounded like blame shifting to me, and I wondered whether some more innocent heads were being set up to roll. Dennis and I just listened. After he left, we laughed. Had Craig sent Marseca to test us? If so, how stupid did Craig think we were? On the other hand, were we getting paranoid? On 1 October 1993, I got my wish and was given a new assignment. I was fully prepared to admit that the Clinton administration had finally won. They had gotten to me, and I didn't want to be a party to the mock security program they wanted to run. All of the early attempts to make the best of it, to put a good face on it, came down to a feeling, finally, that the Clinton administration was a corrupt disaster, beyond redemption or repair. My new assignment included conducting background investigations on House committee staff members, and on staff appointed to new positions at the White House, an executive branch agency, or any position that required Senate confirmation. The extensive caseload was just what I needed to keep my mind off the Clinton White House. Starting 1 October, my routine would be to drive down to the White House, open the office, and sort through my messages and mail. I'd make a few calls, take care of some paperwork, and set up appointments with congressmen and staff. Then I'd leave the White House, drive down to the Hill, and spend the rest of my day walking from appointment to appointment through the Capitol building, the Cannon, Longworth, and Rayburn House office buildings, and sometimes the Annex, which was once home to the FBI's fingerprint division. The Annex is where I and hundreds of other FBI agents were trained to take and read fingerprints and photograph crime scenes. When I did conduct investigations at the White House, the cases involved residents and permanent staff, secretaries, gardeners, and career staff at the OMB, the NSC, the Council of Economic Advisers, and the U.S. Trade Representative's office. I benefited because now I could investigate persons who were not closely associated with the Clintons. I figured I'd discover fewer character problems. I was right. It was a relief. October 1st was also the Secret Service's moment of truth. They had threatened to refuse entry to all temporary White House pass holders on that date. Would they do it? Would they get away with it? I waited to see who would blink, the Secret Service or the Council's office. On October 5th, 1993, I had coffee with a Secret Service pal. Was the Secret Service finally given access to the FBI background investigations? Well, yes and no. Yes, Kennedy has promised that we'll be able to see them, but only about 50 a week. So far, we haven't received the 50 we were promised this week, so I don't know what to believe. Plus, the only issue we can comment on is dangerousness. He went on to explain that their role had been significantly reduced. If the Secret Service can't prove that a staffer is dangerous, then we have to issue a permanent pass, even though a staffer might still have a history of theft, drug use, or even mental problems. The drug question comes down to this. Is the staffer using drugs now, today, inside the White House? If so, we can bar entry, unless they go into some kind of drug rehab program. Otherwise, it makes no difference what they used, when they used it, or how much they used. In other words, hardcore drug users could be White House employees in the Clinton administration if they promised to quit after they were caught. He also explained that if past drug use included the sale of illegal drugs, then they might be able to make a case for denying a permanent pass. But even so, that decision could be overridden by a simple one-paragraph memorandum by White House counsel, saying, in effect, "I don't care what the Secret Service says. Issue the pass. We'll take responsibility." Some security system. The Secret Service wasn't happy with it. But apparently this was coming from above, from the new director of Secret Service, or from Ron Noble, a political appointee who was over both the Secret Service and the ATF. Noble was rumored to be a close friend of Margaret Williams, Hillary's powerful chief of staff. And in a battle like that, the Secret Service didn't stand a chance. On 6 October 1993, George Saunders came by our office. His contract had expired, and he thought that perhaps it might be his last day at the White House. He'd tried to get a heads up from Craig or Bill Kennedy, but neither would say anything.